Now, the Kerry slug was catapulted into the limelight in recent months when an oral hearing into the proposed South Kerry Greenway heard that it would suffer from unmitigated noise disturbance in the construction of the 32-kilometre cycle path. The rare spotted slug, Geomalacus maculosus, is protected under the EU Habitats Directive. It's been found in numbers at two locations, one rock and one heath. But what's so special about this slug? We're joined in studio now by Dr. Aidan O'Hanlon, Curator of Entomology at the Natural History Division at the National Museum of Ireland. Aidan, what is so special about the Kerry slug?
Well, one of the reasons why it's protected in Ireland and internationally is because it only occurs in the southwest of Ireland and the northwest of Iberia, Spain and Portugal. It's the Kerry slug because it was found first in Kerry and later discovered in Spain and Portugal, so they wouldn't call it the Kerry slug. Colloquially, they'd probably just call it Geomalacus or the spotted slug. It's special because it's extremely rare globally. It only occurs, as I said, in a small pocket of the southwest of Ireland and northwest of Iberia. And at the time that it was included on the Habitats Directive, there were indications that populations in Iberia and northern Spain and Portugal were in decline. We now know that Irish populations of the Kerry slug seem to be in favourable status, at least according to the last MPWS Article 17 report. But it's still true to say that Ireland is a stronghold for this species. Legally, it's our obligation to protect the species anyway.
It's not our only slug, is it?
No. We've got about 30 or so different slug species. It's our only protected slug. I think it might be the only protected slug species in the world, as far as I know.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, so it's a large enough slug. There are two different colour forms. You find brown individuals live in sort of forested habitats, woodlands, and out in the open peatland areas like Blanket Bog, the slugs tend to be jet black with white spots.
And are they as big as your finger? I mean, you say big enough. I mean, we know the garden slugs. Some of them are huge.
Some of them are huge, yeah.
So how big is this one?
The garden slug is probably a good rule of thumb because they're...
As big as your thumb.
They're maybe a bit bigger even, but they're from the same taxonomic family. They're the same sort of body shape as well. The Kerry slugs are very distinctive because of their kind of colour and their spotted patternings that they have.
Because the one way of knowing a Kerry slug, apparently, I'm told, is you gather one as a specimen because you want to make sure that it's it. You put it in the matchbox, and when you open the matchbox again, there it is, gone, because it's absolutely able to squeeze itself into two dimensions, so it can slither out of the tiny little crack where the matchbox drawer closes, and no other slug is able to do that. Is that actually true?
They're definitely good at escaping. Myself and colleagues, we used to do behavioural experiments on them in our lab over in the Applied Ecology Unit in NUI Galway. And as part of that was we had this lovely sophisticated camera set up to track their behaviour. And we were interested in all sorts of things, but this would just sort of track their movement and we could manipulate experiments then. And they always escaped. And of course, that was in Galway and we were always worried
that... They're going to catch them on the camera escaping.
You would, yeah, but it's already too late because you'd leave them in a room with the camera on and go back later on and find, oh no, it's not in the arena.
There they are gone.
We'd always find them again, but we were always worried that because those experiments were in Galway, that if it shows up in Galway then we've accidentally introduced a protected species onto the campus, but luckily we haven't found it there. We always recover
them. So they're indicators of ancient woodland then, aren't they? Isn't that certainly the woodland ones are in ancient woodland. That was their original thing. But they're here and they're in Spain and Portugal. Did they come to here from Spain and Portugal? Did they go to Spain and Portugal from here? Do we have any concept of where they came? Have we any DNA work done on them to tell us where they might have come from and how they might have come?
Yeah, this was probably the first mystery of Kerry slugs, was this so-called Lusitanian distribution pattern that it only lives in the southwest of Ireland, northwest of Spain, and it's absent from the rest of Western Europe and Britain. So it puzzled people for a long time how it could have gotten here, because if it came naturally, you'd expect to find it sort of along the route from Spain into Britain and Ireland. But a friend of mine, Dr. Inge Reich, did some genetic work on Irish and Spanish populations a few years ago and found out that the genetic structure of Irish populations, that they're quite impoverished compared to their Iberian cousins, which have highly structured population-level DNA between geographic populations of the Kerry slug. So based on that, it appears...
So ours are all the same, essentially.
Ours are all the same, and not that they're all the same, but that they're, it's the founder effect, is basically. It's a good example of the founder effect. It shows that the Kerry slugs were probably introduced here as an ancient introduction at least hundreds of years ago, but maybe thousands of years ago.
So they would have come perhaps then with the Mesolithic peoples who brought us the pygmy shrew, which apparently has been traced back to Andorra. And there seems to be some evidence that these Mesolithic peoples came in small boats directly from the north of Spain to Ireland, hence not hopping off in France or in Britain. so that some of other species are here in Spain as well. And it's these Mesolithic people, the hunter-gatherers, that would have done this way back maybe up to 8,000 years ago.
It's possible, yeah. One of the theories that Inga had, and it was based on some plants that showed up as well with a similar distribution pattern, was that whenever it may have been hundreds or possibly thousands of years ago, ancient people were wrapping up amphorae of wine in heathers from the mountains in Spain and transporting this as cargo over to Ireland. And that the mountains in Spain are sort of where this slug lives over there, in and amongst the heathers and the wetlands. And it only takes one because they're hermaphrodites.
Or even eggs,
exactly, yeah. And so then hundreds of years later now we have large populations.
Well, I mean, all our slugs and snails are hermaphrodite, but don't they need another hermaphrodite snail to do the business with? But these can bend over and do it to themselves, can they really?
They can, yeah. So all, as you said, all slugs and snails, terrestrial slugs and snails, are simultaneously hermaphroditic. Apparently, most slugs and snails will choose to outcross, will find a mating partner. But there's enough experimental work done, not with Kerry slugs, but with other slug species, that shows that they need a social cue. So if they're in an environment where they can't find another slug or snail, seemingly that's when they'll choose to self-fertilise and essentially produce clones of themselves.
I'd like to ask you about the animal itself. I mean, this is a specialist kind of animal. I remember seeing these slugs, and there was the big black Arionator slug in the same area. Yeah. They were quite common, the black version on the open with the white dots was very common, and so was the Arionator. Now, what exactly specialised? All they're doing is scraping up algae and lichens. I mean, it's a very primitive kind of thing. What on earth is the specialisation of this beast? What makes it different? How does it make a specialist living in a place like Kerry where the other slugs don't?
Well, just on what you brought up about the colour of them, that you saw that the black slugs with the white spots, I assume it was out in a peatland or maybe in a clear area.
It was on the McGillicuddy's reefs the last time. I have a great memory of them on the McGillicuddy's, and they were quite common, you know. Yeah. You could see them in lots of places, and they're supposed to be nocturnal, and here they're out in the daylight. But go on anyway, I'm leading you astray.
It's probably raining.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it turns out that apart from the Lusitanian distribution mystery, one of the other oldest mysteries associated with this species is why it appears in these two different colour forms. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we found out recently enough, and it's a fascinating story. So juvenile slugs hatch as these small, brown, creamy, white, yellow-spotted individuals in both open habitats like peatlands and in sort of oak-ash woodlands as well. In the oak-ash woodlands, as they become adults, after 2 years they become reproductively mature and they retain this brown coloration. And in the forest you find them only really living on tree trunks. So they move up and down the tree trunks, in and amongst the moss, grazing on lichens that grow on the tree bark. And they are perfectly camouflaged. So when it was first discovered by a Dubliner called William Andrews back in 1842, he sensed that it might have been a species of some novelty, basically because it looked so much like the clumps of moss that he found it in. And then he sent it off to a Cork man called George Allman, who would later describe it as a new species and a new genus. But so there's always been that mystery as to why it's so perfectly camouflaged, and then indeed why are there two separate colours? Is it a genetic thing? Are there different
populations? You didn't try to, when you were photographing them escaping in between the times, you didn't take a woodland one and feed it on stuff from the bog and see would it change colour. You didn't try that, did you?
The story is even weirder than that. We tried to do a bit of that. We thought for a while it might have been diet related, because it makes sense that they might be eating different species of lichen on a boulder outcrop in a bog than what might grow amongst the moss on a tree. We found populations of them living in conifer forests as well, where they seem to thrive, which is even more unusual.
What colour were they there?
They're brown, but in Clearfell sites right beside it, you'd find the black individuals. And they're really noticeable because they're not camouflaged. They're not on a big dirty black boulder anymore. They're right out on a perfectly clean tree stump and they stick out like a sore thumb. So we thought that was unusual because 2 metres away you have a mature stand of forestry where you've got all the brown coloured slugs with the whites, with the yellow spots. They look exactly like moss. And then 2 metres away from that, you've got a Clearfell site where they're all jet black. So that was a real head-scratcher. And we assumed it was camouflage anyway. So myself and my supervisor did a study using digital photography with a standardised colour card in the wild. So we wanted to find out, first of all, is this camouflage? And so we sort of measured objectively the colour scores of the slug against the substrate and just measured them up, that does the brown slug match the black substrate and vice versa. And so they're matched against the habitats that they live in. So in other words, the brown slug looks like a tree, the black slug with the white spots looks like a lichen-dotted boulder, but the camouflage doesn't work the other way around, so they're mismatched if they're in the wrong habitat. So that was interesting enough, and it turns out that what happens is, as the juveniles develop into adults, they require insulation to change colour. So they'll change colour within their lifetime if a slug happens to develop in an open habitat like a blanket bog or indeed a clear fell. UV radiation causes their skin to produce more melanin, and this gives them the correct camouflage.
So they're suntanned?
It's like an extreme suntan, yeah. Yeah, and it takes about 6 months or so. In the lab, anyway, it took about 6 months. In Irish wilderness, it probably takes a bit longer because it's not that sunny all the time, but certainly UV is still getting through. So they seem to be able to change.
So the woodland ones are the pale-skinned ones who don't venture out into the sunshine.
Exactly.
And the ones out in the open bog. It's to do with the amount of UV light and similarly a clear fell. So it's not to do with the background, it's to do with the incoming radiation.
Exactly, yeah. And they hedge their bets by being able to become one colour or another in each habitat type.
And has it got ears?
No.
Well then, how can it suffer from unmitigated noise disturbance in the construction of the 32-kilometre cycle path? I mean, what's going on there, really?
I'm not sure. I can't really comment on the Greenway situation because I haven't read the plans. I haven't read any of the environmental impact statements.
But surely noise is the wrong word. I mean, there's going to be disturbance if they're putting in a cycle path. They're changing. They must obviously have to make a track through things. But, I mean, noise. I mean, surely...
That's vibration. Noise is only vibration at the end of the day. And presumably they will detect vibration in the ground. So they are sensitive to vibration.
Yeah, but I mean...
It seems very odd indeed to suggest that making a track is going to endanger a species which is strong and probably thriving.
Well, we don't know whether this was actually permission is given or not. This was just something that was said at the oral hearing. But I mean, if the people who want to save the Sairy Clug, they should actually say vibrations rather than noise, because people like me are going to say have their ears and things like this.
Now, the climate change is rushing ahead. Now, surely this fella is going to thrive. He's going to disappear in Spain and Portugal because they're going to become increasingly desert-like. So it won't suit them at all.
Are you sure of that?
Well, nobody's sure of anything. The future is always different from what we expected. In Ireland, it's getting wetter and it's moist and it should be perfect for our Kerry slug, and he should be thriving. Is he thriving? And
are we the Limerick
slug? Is he one of those rare beneficiaries of climate change? Is he one that the people who were in favour of letting the climate go to hell, can they say, oh, the Kerry slug is with us?
Well, it turns out that there was some modelling work, computer modelling work done a few years ago, and they modelled the future distribution of Kerry slugs, or the theoretical future distribution of Kerry slugs, mapping its climate space and what's known about where it lives in Ireland now. And it looks like it will win out. It'll be one of the very, very few winners in the future. To go back to Richard's question about why this slug is unique, or is it unique in any way, is again, for some unknown reason, when you pick it up, if you remove it from its substrate, it curls up into a ball. And the mucus doesn't go viscous then. It actually becomes really slippery and watery. I don't know why. I've always thought that was some sort of anti-bird mechanism.
Yeah, slip out of the bill.
Exactly, yeah.
Bird can't hold it.
Curls up into a ball and becomes very, very slippery. I'd imagine a bird would have a very hard time.
Snakes do something similar.
But slugs do ordinary garden slugs go like a fruit pastille or something.
They hump up a little bit.
But they're not
right.
A ball. Yeah. They're only like a humpy thing. These are complete balls. You could roll them along like a marble, could you?
You could, actually,
I'm surprised you haven't managed a captive breeding thing with this. I mean, it seems ideal. You should be able to set up something in the botanic gardens or somewhere with lots of moisture and have loads and loads of these fellows for us to see and bring the kids to see.
I thought the same thing too. I thought it'd be very easy, and it broke my heart, Richard. I did try and set up a captive breeding program. Again, we were collecting...
But they all escaped.
They didn't all escape. No, some of them escaped and were subsequently recaptured, of course. But we were working with slugs. It's a protected species, of course. So
need a license. Obviously.
We need a license, and our licenses were given from the National Parks and Wildlife. So you can only have so many slugs in captivity, and then you release them again afterwards after you're finished studying them. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I wanted to do was set up a captive breeding program, mainly to understand how they reproduce and when, what time of the year, how old they are, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What numbers of eggs do they give off and so on. And also to have a conveyor belt of slugs to do
more
behavioural
work,
experiments with and figure things out. And it came up, I read a paper that was somebody from the UK was looking at pond snails, and they had a great captive breeding system. It was so easy. They gave the snails in captivity, they kept them in small lunch boxes and gave them everything they needed. So they had a full balanced diet, they had nice little shelters, and the only thing they were missing was any sort of a social element. So they'd separate them out individually into their own little containers for a period of about 2 months. And then when they put them back in together, the only new stimulus they had was other individuals of the same species. So they got into a breeding frenzy. And I thought, that's grand. I'll try that with the Kerry slugs. And I spent about 2 months just separating them out, keeping them all in individual containers.
Mind the mice at the crossroads, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. 2 months later, put them back in. Again, just a pair of two slugs. Watched them for another couple of months and nothing happened. And I go, all right, I'll give up. Eventually gave up and then I sort of put them back into, I was keeping them in containers with more than about five slugs, I think it was. And as soon as I got them back into their big mixed containers, I went to check them one day and there were eggs everywhere. So I don't know if the experiment worked. Or
so they want to be at a dance. They don't want just an intimate relationship at a deux. So it's not couples. They want.
It could also just be that they... Sorry?
It must have been about 2 years old before they breed or something like that.
It's yeah, they don't breed until they don't become reproductively mature until they're at least 2 years old. And even
so
that...
You have to live a long time to do these experiments.
Yeah, yeah.
So they prefer the disco scene.
Maybe they do, yeah. But they live for 8 years at least. There's records of them in captivity living for up to 8 years. They don't become reproductively mature until they're about 2 years old. But even at that, it's very difficult to tell if you've got a fully mature slug, because even a slug that's about 6 months old could be a massive big thing.
How do you know all those eggs came from mating, or whether they all just mated with themselves then and discussed?
We don't know that either. Yeah, that's why I was heartbroken by that that waste of a few months that sort of went nowhere. But that's how research goes.
Well, you've brought it to life. Did the eggs ever hatch? I mean, did you ever have little babies?
Oh, they did. Yeah, they did.
And you had to put all those back as well, had you?
Yeah. We reintroduced all of
them. Well, Kerry will never be the same again.
No. I'll never be the same again. That was fascinating, I have to say. It was really interesting. I know a lot more. I feel for the Kerry slug in a way that I never did before, I have to say. So, Aidan, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Thanks to Richard and Naina, to our sound operator, Sheila DeVuille. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Riley. And producer is Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye.